All right, yeah, I feel like I've had a really great setup from all of the previous speakers. I do want to say, so I'm not a medical doctor. My background is in human development. I have a degree in developmental psychology, and I have a degree in environmental psychology. And I'm based in the urban planning branch of the School of Environmental Design at the University of Colorado in Boulder. So I'm coming at this from a different direction, and I'm new to APHA. And I do want to mention there is a study that came out in 2012. I don't know, Daphne, Howie, if you're aware of the work of Catherine Ward Thompson is doing with her research team in Scotland right now. It came out in Landscape and Urban Planning, so if you need to be reading that literature, which is the literature I read, and it's indicating that what may be going on, the mechanism that may underlie this, they're working again with low-income populations, very similar to the Robert Taylor Holmes quasi-experimental design that Howie Frumkin showed you, looking at people who happen to get into low-income housing with the trees and vegetation around their buildings and those who don't, and actually getting them to keep cortisol, do cheek swabs several times a day, so we have the cortisol patterns, and finding that the regulation of the whole hypothalamic pituitary adrenal system appears to be kept in a state of well-functioning when people have that everyday nature around them. This is a pilot study that was published, and they're very eagerly now going on with a much bigger N and thinking they really may be on to what's underlying some of these benefits. So I have no financial relationships to disclose other than, like Daphne, donations to green space groups. I'm not going to spend time specifically on the benefits to children of contact with nature. You have a website there you can go to where we have a fact sheet about it. We also have one on the benefits of gardening for children. When I say we, I'm talking about the Children, Youth, and Environments Center in our environmental design program that I'm connected with. And you'll see a lot more of the work we do. But I've also learned now that I cannot talk about sending your child outside to connect with the natural world unless I also add and make sure it has not been sprayed by insecticides and pesticides. And of course it is you in a public health, many public health researchers and like Dick Jackson and others who've worked on that field of toxins in the environment, and we have to remember to mention that too. And I think that then lobbying for organic lawn and garden care in these places where we tell people to take their children is another really important piece that we must not forget to do. Okay. So my talk is based, as Layla said, on my work for 10 years coordinating the Growing Up in Cities project with UNESCO, United Nations Environmental, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, at the same time as UNICEF was developing its Child-Friendly Cities Initiative. So we both did this from UNESCO and UNICEF in preparation for the big city summit, the Habitat Agenda meeting in 1996 by the United Nations. So in preparation for that, we were developing our programs together with a lot of collaboration and coordination between us. Before I go into that and say some more about these programs, I want to say that as a psychologist coming in and looking at what you're doing here with Nature Contact in the American Public Health Association, I see parallels with psychology. But I think in some ways psychology represents kind of where you may be moving. I was struck that when I go through the program for the meeting here, if you look in the index, I think you can see how new the topic of this session is. There's no index word for nature, no index word for parks, no index word for open space, no index word for green space. in the program that you are all carrying with you, which I think certainly says something about where public health as a whole is. And I think there's a parallel here because, as you've been hearing from these preceding presentations, we're talking about something which has multiple benefits. It's true, Howie says, we do need more research. But in fact, since those early studies that he told you about in the late 1970s, early 1980s, we're really in a condition where we could start doing reviews of the literature because there is so much literature out there. And I think what's compelling about it is it's showing benefits physically, cognitively, emotionally, and socially. So in all of these different dimensions of people's lives, and I think we're looking at something where we're moving away from a focus on the pathologies of health, which is critical, which is certainly a necessary part of what, and will always be an essential part of what public health is doing. But we're beginning to move into an area where we're really looking at how do we create the conditions for human flourishing, for optimal human functioning, and this access to the natural environment appears to be a piece of creating communities like that. Another piece, which I think is already much more part of your tradition in public health, is the citizen participation. So I'm going to be talking about both, putting that together with a focus on young people. The participation piece, which I'll argue is also critical for a full-dimensioned health in our human functioning in the world, and the nature contact piece. So both the Growing Up in Cities project with UNESCO and UNICEF's Child Friendly Cities Initiative, I'm talking about them because they're the base I work on, but they're also tools for you. That are there, that have a great body of experience behind them, and that you can use in taking this to populations of children and youth in particular. They are rights-based. They're based on the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. How many of you are familiar with the CRC, the Convention on the Rights of the Child? Good. Okay. Quite a number of you are. And how many of you are aware that the United States is one of two nations of the United Nations which has not ratified it? Yeah. And it's not anti-child rights in particular, but it's part of, at this point in our history, Congress's reluctance to engage in any kind of convention with the United Nations. But there are 54 articles in the convention, and they are clustered in three types of rights. And so one of these are the rights you are very familiar with in your practice, which is protecting children. So protecting them from violence, from exploitation, abuse, and also protecting them from dangerous environments, including pollution in areas that you work on. And another cluster of rights is about providing for their basic needs, and I think, again, there'd be no controversy about that, and it's also what you're engaged in, because certainly one of those basic needs is healthcare, an essential need, safe water, proper sanitation, again, other areas of your work in public health. But there's a third cluster of articles, which are participation articles, which argue that children have a right to participate in informal ways, in terms of being integrated into their culture and their society, its public places, its events, and also in general the basic principle that they have a right to a voice in decisions that impact their lives. And the United Nations Commission on Human Rights that reviews children's rights reports, the United Nations Commission on Children's Rights, has made it very clear that this includes a right to a voice in decisions that impact their environments, because those impact their lives in so many ways. I'm sure you're all familiar with the definition of health from the World Health Organization, that it is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. That, of course, then raises the question, well, what does that mean? What is a state of complete well-being? The United Nations, again, taking up this question and taking it up within the philosophy of human rights, has turned to Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate, economist, philosopher, bringing in Martha Nussbaum, an Aristotle scholar here from the United States, who developed their response to that question and argued for a capabilities approach to human well-being. How many of you are familiar with that? Okay, it's wonderful work. I refer you to it. And the argument here is what constitutes us as human beings? What are our special capacities that define us as a human being? And the more that we fully develop those different constructive capabilities, the more fully we find health, well-being, the more we flourish, the more we find happiness. So here, for example, this is taken from Martha Nussbaum's work, which was actually she did working with low-income women in India, such as rag pickers, shack dwellers. And here are just a few of her throwing out, what are those basic capabilities that define us as a human being? And I put in green all the ones that I think are connected to children's and youth engagement in evaluating green spaces in their communities and having a role in designing them and actually constructing them, creating them. I put a child in the middle. As I said, Martha Nussbaum worked with women, where certainly I would have to also put in green being able to own property, which is an issue in many countries. But I think the point here is that being able to shape the environment we live in is absolutely fundamental to agency, to autonomy, to that sense of self-efficacy as an individual and collective efficacy because we need to do this working in groups. It's also absolutely essential to developing as an active citizen. And you all know how critical it is to have an engaged active citizenry working with you on the issues that are central to your profession. So this is the underlying kind of philosophy, the foundation behind both of these programs. Growing up in cities is a set of tools, and I'll show you in the end a couple books that we've done related to it, of ways to engage children and youth in through intergenerational partnerships to create better cities, and really better cities for all ages. So here, for example, this is, if you think of a quadrants where we have the social environment of children's lives and the physical environment of their lives, and this is the quadrant where it's all going right. That is based on work that we did in 10 low-income neighborhoods in Africa, Asia, North America, South America, Europe, and Australia, where we were doing very close comparative work at using the same methods, looking at what 10 to 14-year-olds were saying in different low-income neighborhoods about what really mattered to them, what made good places to grow up. And then we compared it with work that was done using similar methods in the 1970s with eight different low-income neighborhoods. And so there is actually some very close comparison going on behind this. And I think, so this is what these young people say, make a good place in which to grow up. And you can see I put green areas in green, access to safe natural spaces was always highly valued when it was available. And I think one of the things that's important here is to young people, the social and the physical are not separated. To people doing good work and design, they're not separated either. As the architect Christian Norberg Schultz said, life takes place. We have to have places to do all the things we want to do socially. So they go together, and they're very interdependent, the social and the physical there. And what strikes me, too, is looking at this. So this comes from, what is a good place to grow up? But look at those elements. Well, those are the elements of a sustainable city for all ages, aren't they? And so what we found, this is one of our growing up in cities, one of our methods where children take us as researchers on tours around their neighborhoods and show us the risks and also the resources for them. And I think it's a good example of how highly prized nature was wherever they could find it. And often these kids lived in very stark neighborhoods, very harsh neighborhoods. This is a boy in the South Bronx taking us to show him his favorite tree, a really important resource for him, and not at all atypical. So building, so that shows you very quickly some outcomes from growing up in cities work, and I'll refer you in the end where you can find all the tool of methods that we use. Child-Friendly Cities of UNICEF, on the other hand, is about looking at children's rights and integrating them into all levels of government. Now, a public health agency is a unit of governance, broadly construed, and there's no reason why you cannot look at these elements of children's rights. You don't need to wait for national endorsement by Congress. And ask yourself, is your agency really responsive to them? Is it operating in a way that respects these rights? And I think our basic dictum is that if you're doing this, you don't need to worry. You're really not just serving children and youth, because a city that is friendly for children is friendly for all ages, and we find that over and over again in our work. So I'm going to very quickly, I know it's a session's about over, very quickly just show you a few slides of what we're doing with our Growing Up Boulder project. We are not waiting for congressional ratification of the we've actually had some high school students who got really excited over the idea of children's rights and have drafted their own Child and Youth Bill of Rights in a very participatory way. And you just see a few activities of many events that we had to get young people's input on, for them, what would be a Bill of Rights for their city. And we're ready to move forward with that. So they're different. Again, we also have UN Habitat, which we work with. So I do want to say, yes, Boulder is a progressive city. It is a high-income city. But if you look at these city stats, you can see that we're not immune. People call us a barbell city, I think very appropriately. We have many services for low-income families. We also have a lot of high-end, a lot of money, the middle class being squeezed out in between. And you can see we have many advantages compared to other cities, but we have a 23% poverty rate among children under 5, and that is growing. That's a rapidly growing sector of our population, is child poverty. So the critical thing in engaging children and youth as agents and doing this work that you're talking about and creating access to green spaces is partnerships. Our particular partnership is between our Children, Youth, and Environments Center in the university and all of the university branches we can tap into and coordinate. The Boulder Valley School District, which is a wonderful partner, which gives us access to many different kinds of classes and groups of children. And the city is very much behind this. So you need leadership at the top. It could be your public health agency, which is up there at the top, is one of the drivers of this in partnership with other groups. But the really critical thing is to develop the networks where you're working with many community-based groups, which are right there working day to day with where children are. And building affiliations with groups which give you access to the different populations you want to reach. So children of different ethnicities, children of different income levels, children of different ages. And so, for example, we partner, one of the groups we partner with is Boulder Housing Partners, and that gives us access to all the low-income housing developments in the city. And this is just one issue, one example of there. We have a close working relationship with the lowest the largest low-income housing development, and we our entry into that, where we're doing, I've done many things, was through engaging with children in the community and creating the garden, the community garden, for their housing development, providing fresh vegetables for their families. We worked with the city at the level of getting child and youth voices into the comprehensive plan. When the city's targeted an area for redevelopment, they come to us and we do activities with these different groups that we're connected with to get children and youth ideas about what they would want to see in that neighborhood redevelopment to make it a good place for them. And green spaces always come up. They always come up as one of the essential priorities that young people identify. So just to here, I'm closing very quickly with some slides of two concurrent projects that we're involved in. The city has targeted the downtown civic area. So for example, some of these we just went to get kids who were there at the farmer's market on a Saturday morning, and we do one of the many exercises we do, we call it framing. They have green frames for things they like, red frames for things that are problematic in these neighborhood spaces, and then they write commentaries about it, and now with digital media, they can put those together right away. And it also, you see, we're working with a group of I Have a Dream Foundation, which works with first-time college-going youth, kids who would be the first children in their families to attend college. We've worked with an elementary school. We're a term-long project. This was a capstone project for graduating fifth graders from their elementary school on how do you create public spaces which are accessible to all abilities. And so as you can see, we brought in wheelchairs, we brought in tapping sticks and blindfolds, and the kids could check them out of the library and actually first begin to get used to what does it mean to move around spaces with different abilities. And then went from there to learning about design for accessible green spaces, to create an accessible playground. And then they're presenting their models and their work that they've done. Each class took a different part of their playground to design, and with a commitment from the school that they would integrate some of their ideas into the playground renovation. And you don't have any problems with discipline when you're doing projects like this with kids. And I'm almost done. I know we're running a little bit over. If you want to have a sustainable future, you want to have sustainable and healthy cities, you've got to have young people who are prepared to lead it, to take over the leadership and take us there and keep us there and pass it on in turn. So as the school is being redeveloped, renovated to be a green school, we take our design students into the school and they work with the kids on understanding what that means and really knowing the technology of green building. And now, so they've done this in a middle school where there was major green school renovation. And the kids actually sat on the committee with the architects. And then they did a lot of research in their school about what were the elements that teachers and other students wanted integrated into the school renovation and were there to speak up about it. And now they've moved out and they're working on the schoolyard garden design. And very last one, just a couple slides here. But this is a very active current project because our Parks Department wants to make it a model for how it wants to do all future parks. And what you have here is a home for assisted living for the elderly. So you've got those two communities right next to each other. And so starting with the school, what we're doing is involving the school children in first doing an inventory of all the plants and animals that are in that park as it's now targeted for ecological restoration. There have been problems with mosquitoes from the pond, which can be addressed through ecological restoration. So the children and youth are studying it. They're creating an outdoor classroom. They're going to be using that park as a regular part of their curriculum for science and art and writing. And they're also going, they're also the ambassadors to engage the older people to get their ideas about what they want to see in the park renovation. So it will be these two communities of the elders and the children working together. And this is a view of the park. It is beautiful, but it is actually in the middle of a very densely populated area. The children have started, their first activity was with their school ground of designing what they wanted, again, for a playground renovation. And the Parks Department is going to help the school district in actually creating that with the children being there for the planting and to make it happen. And what has come from that is putting all of their ideas together is a natural playscape. So I think when we're talking about taking kids outside, it doesn't have to be parks that are at a distance from where you are. Bring nature where children are. Bring it to their child care center yards. Bring it to their schools through schoolyard greening. Make it part of their day-to-day environment. So go where the children are. And the last thing I want to say, here's just some websites. Let me show you quickly a couple books. That one, Creating Better Cities for Children and Youth, gives you lots of tools, and including some very creative tools for engaging children and youth in these processes. In response to what you were saying, in design now, there is a whole field of biophilic design, which is doing exactly what you were talking with, Daphne, in terms of the hospital there. And it comes out of a critique of green building technologies, which are wonderful, they're good. We need those zero emissions buildings, we need non-toxic buildings. But again, we can do more than that. And I think this is, again, an example of design going from, let's not just think of the pathologies, the deficits, let's think about what can be optimal and saying, okay, so, what we need to do is take all of those green building technologies, put them together with biophilic design, build buildings that connect people to nature in their homes, in their workplaces, their hospitals, their schools, connect them to their local landscape. And then you have what we're calling restorative design. It restores ecosystems and it restores human health and the human spirit. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dr. Chawla. That was amazing. Wonderful to see your great models, and hopefully we'll be able to have the resources to replicate them in other places. Sorry we ran late. Our speakers were fabulous. Let's give them another round of applause. And I hope, we're not going to be able to have a question and answer session unless you all want to stay and our speakers want to stay. Officially, I'm going to close the session, but hopefully we'll be able to have some conversation up here. Thank you all.